became perplexed as he thought it all over. For all anyone knew, he had not prepared a thing to say and needed a moment to compose his thoughts. After LeJudas's long opening, which somehow managed to seem both rehearsed and rambling, Jonathan's rumpled spontaneity was a breath of fresh air. Now, I admire Jonathan, and I like him too, so I may be placing a thumb on the scale for him, but it seemed to me, even before he opened his mouth to speak, that he was the more likable of the two lawyers, which is no small thing. Compared with LeJudas, who seemed unable to draw a breath without calculating how it would be seen by others, Jonathan was all naturalness, all ease. Slouching in the courtroom in his lousy suit, distracted by his own thoughts, he looked as at home as a man in his pajamas in his own kitchen eating over the sink. "You know," he began, "I think about one thing," he said, "the lawyer for the government." He waved his arm behind him in the general direction of LeJudas. "The death of a young man like Ben Rifkin is awful. Even among all the crimes, all the murders, all the terrible things we see here, it's just tragic. He was just a boy. And all the years this boy had in front of him, all the things he might have become, the great doctor, the great artist, the wise leader, it's all lost. All lost. When you see a tragedy as enormous as that, you want to make it right. You want to fix it somehow. You want to see justice done. Maybe you feel angry. You want to see someone pay. We all feel these things. We're all only human. But Jacob Barber is innocent. I want to say that again so there's no misunderstanding. Jacob Barber is completely innocent. He did nothing at all. He had nothing to do with this murder. This is the wrong man. The evidence you just heard about, it all turns out to be nothing. The moment you scratch the surface, the moment you look at it, you understand what really happened, and the state's case blows away like smoke. That fingerprint, for example, which the government lawyer made so much of, you will hear how that fingerprint got there, just as Jacob told the policeman who arrested him the moment he was asked. He found his classmate lying on the ground wounded, and he did what any good person would do. He tried to help. He rolled Ben over to check on him, to see if he was okay, to help him. And when he saw Ben was dead, he did the exact same thing many of us would do. He got scared. He did not want to get involved. He worried that if he told anybody he'd seen the body, let alone touched it, he would become a suspect. He might be accused of something he did not do. Was that the right reaction? Of course not. Does he wish he had been braver and told the truth right from the start? Of course he does. But he is a boy, he is human, and he made a mistake. There's no more to it than that. Don't... He stopped, looked down, considered his next sentence. Don't let it happen twice. One boy is dead. Don't destroy another innocent boy to make up for it. Don't let this case become a second tragedy. We've had enough tragedy already. The first witness was Paula Gianetto, the jogger who discovered the body. I did not know this woman, but I recognized her from around town, from the market or Starbucks or the dry cleaner. Newton is not a small town, but it is divided into several villages, and within these neighborhoods the same faces keep popping up. Oddly, I did not remember seeing her jogging in Cold Spring Park, though apparently we both ran there often around the time of the murder. LeJudas led her through her testimony, which dragged on too long. He was over-thorough, anxious to get from her every last ounce of detail and pathos there was to be got. Ordinarily, for the prosecutor, a funny transformation takes place with the first witness. After standing center stage for his opening statement, the prosecutor now steps out of the spotlight. The focus shifts to the witness, and the rules require the prosecutor to be almost passive in his questions. He steers the witness or prods her along with neutral questions like, "What happened next?" or "What did you see then?" But LeJudas was quite picky about the details he wanted from Paula Gianetto. He kept stopping her to probe about this or that. Jonathan never objected to any of this, since none of the testimony tied Jacob to the murder even remotely. But again, I sensed LeJudas fumbling his case, not by some grand strategic blunder, but inch by inch, in a thousand little ways. Was this wishful thinking? Maybe. I do not pretend to be objective. Gianetta was on the stand for the better part of an hour relating her story, which was essentially unchanged since she first told it the day of the murder. It had been a cool, damp spring morning. She was running along a hilly section of trail through Cold Spring Park when she saw what seemed to be a boy lying face down on a leaf-strewn embankment, which sloped down to a tiny algae-skinned pond. The boy wore jeans, sneakers, and a sweatshirt. His backpack had tumbled down the hill near him. Gianetto was jogging by herself, and she did not see anyone else near the body. She had passed a couple of other joggers and kids walking to school. The park was a common route to the McCormick School, which abutted it. But she saw no one near the body. She had not heard anything either, no cries or sounds of a struggle, since she had been listening to music on her iPod, which she wore in a holder strapped to her upper arm. She was even able to name the song that was playing when she saw the body. "This Is the Day," by a group called The. Gianetto stopped, removed the earbuds of her iPod, and looked down at the boy from the trail above. From just a few feet away, she saw the bottoms of his sneakers, his body foreshortened. She said, "Are you okay? Do you need help?" When she got no response, she went down to check on him, sidestepping carefully down the hill because of the slippery leaves. She was a mother, she said, and she could not imagine not checking on the boy, as she would expect others to do for her kids. She had it in her head that the boy had passed out, maybe from some sickness or allergy, maybe even from drugs or who knew what. So she got down on her knees beside him and jostled his shoulder, then jostled both shoulders, then rolled him over by his shoulders. That is when she saw the blood that soaked his chest and the reddened leaves under him and all around him, still wet and glistening, draining out of the three vent holes in his chest. The boy's skin was gray, but there were small splotches of pink on his face, she said. She had a vague recollection that his skin was cold to the touch, but she had no specific memory of touching it. Perhaps the body had shifted in her hands so that its skin brushed her hand. The head fell back heavily, the mouth gaped open. It took her a moment to process the surreal fact that the boy in her arms was dead. She dropped the body, which she had been holding under the shoulders. She screamed. She slid away from it on her butt, then turned and managed to scramble over the leaves on all fours back up the hill to the trail. For a moment, she said, nothing happened. She stood there, alone in the woods, staring at the body. She could hear the music still playing faintly in her earbuds, still playing This Is the Day. The whole thing had not even lasted the 3 minutes it takes to get through a pop song. It took a ludicrously long time to bring out this simple story. After such a lengthy direct examination, Jonathan's cross was brief almost to the point of comedy. "You never saw the defendant, Jacob Barber, in the park that morning, did you?"
"No."
"No further questions." With the next witness, LeJudas misstepped. No, more than that. He stepped in shit. The witness was the Newton PD detective who had headed up the investigation for the local department. This was a standard pro forma sort of witness. LeJudas had to begin by running a few witnesses up there to establish the essential facts and the timetable of that first day when the murder was discovered. The first responding cop is often called to testify about the state of the murder scene and the critical early moments of the investigation before the case is joined and taken over by the state police CPAC unit. So this was a witness LeJudas had to call, really. He was just following the playbook. I'd have done the same thing. The trouble was, he did not know his witness as well as I did. Lieutenant Detective Nils Petersen joined the force in Newton just a few years before I started at the DA's office, fresh out of law school. Which is to say, I had known Nils since 1984, when Neil LeJudas was in high school struggling to maintain a busy schedule of AP classes, band, and compulsive masturbation. I am speculating. I cannot say for sure that he was in the band. Nils had been handsome when we were younger. He had the sandy blonde hair you might imagine based on his name. Now, in his early 50s, his hair had darkened, his back was a little stooped, his belly thickened. But he had an attractive, soft-spoken demeanor on the stand, with none of the abrasive, cocksure bluster some cops exude. Juries swooned for him. LeJudas took him through the basic facts. The body had been found lying on its back, face up to the sky, having been flipped over by the jogger who discovered it. The pattern of the three stab wounds. The lack of obvious motive or suspects. No signs of struggle or defensive wounds, suggesting a sudden or surprise attack. Photos of the body and the surrounding area were entered into evidence. In the first minutes and hours of the investigation, the park had been sealed and searched, with no results. Several footprints were found in the park, but none in the immediate area of the body, and none that were ever matched to a suspect. In any case, it was a public park. There were probably thousands of footprint traces if you cared to look for them. And then this. LeJudas. Is it the usual procedure that an assistant district attorney is assigned to direct homicide investigations right away? Yes. Who was the assistant district attorney assigned to the case that day? Objection. Judge French. I'll see counsel at sidebar. LeJudas and Jonathan went to the far side of the judge's bench where they talked in low murmurs. Judge French stood tall above them, as was his habit. Most judges wheeled their chairs over to the rail or leaned in close, the better to whisper with the lawyers. Not Bert French. The sidebar conference took place out of the jury's hearing and mine. The next few paragraphs I have cut and pasted from the trial transcript. The judge. Where are you going with this? LeJudas. Your Honor, the jury is entitled to know the defendant's own father was in charge of the early stages of the investigation, particularly if the defense is going to suggest anything was handled improperly, as I suspect they will have to. Counselor. Jonathan. Well, our objection is twofold. First, it is irrelevant. It is guilt by association. Even if the defendant's father should not have taken the case, and even if he mishandled it in some way, and I'm not suggesting that either is true, it still doesn't say a damn thing about the defendant himself. Unless Mr. LeJudas means to suggest the son was involved in a conspiracy with his father to cover up evidence of the crime, then there is no way to construe evidence against the father as having anything to do with the son's guilt or innocence. If Mr. LeJudas wants to indict the father for obstruction of justice or some such thing, then he should go ahead and do it and we'll all come back here someday and we'll have a trial on that. But that's not the case we're trying here. The second objection is that it is improperly prejudicial. It is guilt by insinuation. He is trying to poison the jury with the suggestion that the father must have known the son was involved, and therefore he must have been up to something improper. But there's no evidence either that the father suspected his son, which he certainly did not, or that he did anything improper when he was leading the investigation. Let's be honest, the prosecutor wants to toss a stink bomb into this courtroom to distract the jury from the fact that there is virtually no direct evidence against the defendant. It's, okay, I got it. LeJudas. Your Honor, how important it is, that's for the jury to decide, but they have a right to know. The defendant can't have it both ways. He can't argue that the cops screwed up and then conveniently leave out the fact that the cop in charge was the defendant's own father. The judge. I'm going to allow it. But, Mr. LeJudas, I'm warning you, if this trial gets sidetracked into a discussion of whether the father screwed up intentionally or not, I'm going to cut it off. The defense has a point. That's not the case we're here to try. If you want to indict the father, do it. The transcript does not record LeJudas's reaction, but I remember it well. He looked across the courtroom directly at me. Returning to the little lectern near the jury box, he faced Nils Peterson and resumed his questions. Detective, I'll repeat the question. Who was the assistant DA assigned to the case that day? Andrew Barber. Do you see Andrew Barber in the courtroom here today? Yes, he's right there beside the defendant. And did you know Mr. Barber when he was an assistant DA? Did the two of you ever work together? Sure, I knew him. We worked together many times. Were you friendly with Mr. Barber? Yes, I'd say so. Did it occur to you at the time that it was odd Mr. Barber was handling a case involving his own son's school, a classmate, a boy he might even have known something about? No, not really. Well, did it seem strange to you that Mr. Barber's son might well become a witness in the case? No, I didn't think about that. But when he was leading the case, the defendant's father pushed for a suspect who turned out not to be involved, a man who lived near the park who had a record as a sexual offender. Yes, his name was Leonard Patz. He had a record for indecent A&Bs on kids, things like that. and Mr. Barber, Andrew Barber, the father, wanted to pursue this man as a suspect, did he not? Objection, relevance, sustained. Lejudice. Detective, while the defendant's father was leading the investigation, did you consider Leonard Patz as a suspect? Yes. And Patz was later cleared when the defendant's own son was charged. Objection. Overruled. Peterson hesitated here, seeing the trap. If he went too far to help his friend, he would necessarily help the defense. He tried to find a middle way. Patz was not charged. And when Mr. Barber's son was charged, were you surprised at that point by Mr. Barber's earlier involvement in the case? Objection. Overruled. I thought it was surprising, yes, in the sense, have you ever heard of a prosecutor or a cop becoming involved in an investigation of his own son? Cornered, Peterson drew a deep breath. No. It would be a conflict of interest, wouldn't it? Objection. Sustained. Move on, Mr. Lejudice. Lejudice asked a few more desultory, half-hearted questions, relishing the afterglow of a victory. When he sat down, he had the dopey, flushed face of a man who just got laid, and he kept his head down until he could overmaster it. On cross, Jonathan again did not bother to attack much of anything Peterson had said about the crime scene, because again there was virtually nothing in his rendition that pointed to Jacob. There was so little trace of antagonism between these two soft-spoken guys, in fact, and the questions were also inconsequential that it might have been a defense witness Jonathan was questioning. The body was lying in a twisted position when you arrived at the scene, is that right, Detective? Yes. So given the fact the body had been moved, some evidence had been lost even before you arrived. For example, the position of the body can often help you reconstruct the attack itself, isn't that right? Yes, it is. And when the body is flipped over, the effect of lividity, or the blood settling with gravity, is also reversed. It's like turning over a sand timer. The blood starts to flow the other way, and the inferences you usually draw from lividity are lost, isn't that right? Yes, I'm not a forensics expert, but yes. Understood, but you are a homicide detective. Yes. And it's fair to say that, as a general rule, at a murder scene when the body is disturbed or moved, evidence is often lost. Generally true, yes. In this case, there's no way of knowing if anything was actually lost. Was the murder weapon found? Not that day, no. Was it ever found? No. And besides the single fingerprint on the victim's sweatshirt, there was nothing at all that pointed to a particular defendant. Correct. And of course, the fingerprint was not identified until much later, right? Yes. So, the crime scene itself on that first day did not yield any evidence that pointed to a particular suspect? No, just the unidentified fingerprint. So, it's fair to say that at the beginning of the investigation you didn't have any obvious suspects? Yes. So, in that situation, as an investigator, wouldn't you want to know, wouldn't it be relevant information that a known convicted pedophile lived adjacent to the park? A man with a record of sexual assaults on young boys of about the victim's age? It would. I could feel the jury's eyes on me as they seemed to understand, finally, where Jonathan was going, that he was not simply settling for a series of small hits. So it didn't seem improper or unusual or the slightest bit odd to you when Andy Barber, the defendant's father, focused his attention on this man, this Leonard Patz? No, it didn't. In fact, based on what you knew at the time, he wouldn't be doing his job if he didn't check out this man, would he? No, I don't think so. And in fact, you learned in your subsequent investigation that Patz was indeed known to walk in that park in the mornings, isn't that true? Yes. Objection. There was not much conviction in Lejudice's voice. Overruled. Plenty of conviction in the judge's voice. You opened the door, counselor. I had always disliked Judge French's tendency to let his sympathies show. He was a ham, and generally his emoting favored the defense. His courtroom always felt like a home game for the defendant. Now that I was on the defendant's side, of course, I was delighted to see the judge so openly cheerleading for us. It was an easy ruling anyway. Lejudice had opened this subject. He could not now prevent the defense from exploring it. I gestured to Jonathan, and he came over to accept a piece of paper from me. When he read it, his eyebrows rose. I had written three questions on the paper. He folded the paper neatly and moved closer to the witness stand. "Detective, did you ever disagree with any of the decisions Andy Barber made when he was leading the investigation?" "No." "And in fact, isn't it true that you also wanted to pursue the investigation against this man, Patz, at the beginning of the investigation?" "Yes." A juror, Fat Somerville guy in chair number 7, actually snorted and shook his head. Jonathan heard that guffaw over his shoulder from the jury box, and he looked like he was about to sit down. I gave him a look that said, "Go on." He frowned. "Outside of TV shows, you do not go for the kill on cross-examination. You land a few shots, then sit your ass down. The witness, remember, has all the power, not you. Plus, the third line on that page was the archetypal question you never ask on cross. Open-ended, subjective, the sort of question that invites a long, unpredictable answer. To a veteran lawyer, the feeling was like the moment in a horror movie when the babysitter hears a noise in the basement and opens the creaky door to go down and investigate. 'Don't do it,' the audience says." "Do it," my expression insisted. "Detective," he began, "I know this is awkward for you. I'm not asking you to express any opinion about the defendant himself. I understand you have a job to do on that score. But limiting our discussion to the defendant's father, Andy Barber, whose judgment and integrity has been called into question here—" "Objection. Overruled." "How long have you known the older Mr. Barber?" "A long time." "How long?" 20 years, probably more." "And having known him over 20 years, what is your opinion of him as a prosecutor, with respect to his ability, his integrity, his judgment?" "We're not talking about the son, only the father." "That's right." Peterson looked directly at me. "He's the best they've got. The best they used to have, anyway." "No further questions." No further questions meaning, fuck you. LeJudas would never again focus quite so explicitly on my role in the investigation, though it was a note he touched on a few times in the course of the trial. No doubt that first day he successfully planted the idea in the jurors' minds. For the time being, that may have been all he needed to accomplish. Still, we walked out of the courtroom that afternoon feeling victorious. It didn't last. Chapter 28. A Verdict. Dr. Vogel informed us grimly, "I'm afraid I have some rather difficult things to say." We had all been feeling drained. The stress of a full day in court leaves you bone-tired and muscle-sore. But the doctor's gloom put us on red alert. Lori focused on her with an intent expression, Jonathan with his usual owlish curiosity. Me? "I promise you, we're used to bad news. At this point, we're bulletproof." Dr. Vogel avoided my eyes. "In hindsight, I hear how ridiculous I must have sounded. We parents often talk with ridiculous bravado when it comes to our kids. We swear that we can take any abuse, beat any challenge. No test is too great. Anything for our kids. But no one is bulletproof, parents least of all. Our kids make us vulnerable. In hindsight, I see, too, that this meeting was exquisitely timed to break us. Only an hour or so had passed since court had adjourned for the day, and as the adrenaline receded, so did our sense of triumph, leaving us doped, punch-drunk. We were in no shape for bad news. The scene was Jonathan's office near Harvard Square. We were seated around the circular oak table in his book-walled library, just the four of us, Lori and me, Jonathan and Dr. Vogel. Jacob was out in the waiting room with Jonathan's young associate, Ellen. When Dr. Vogel turned away from me, when she could not look me in the eye, she must have been thinking, "You think you're bulletproof? Just wait." "How about you, Lori?" the shrink said in her solicitous, therapeutic voice. "Do you think you can handle this right now?"
"Absolutely."
Dr. Vogel's eyes moved over Lori. Her hair, which kinked up like stretched springs, and her complexion, which now looked jaundiced with dark bags under her eyes. She had lost so much weight, the skin sagged and pouched on her face, and her clothes drooped on her bony shoulders. I thought, when did all this deterioration happen? All at once, with the strain of this case? Or gradually, over the years, without my noticing? This was not my Laurie anymore, the brave girl who invented me and who, it now seemed, I had invented for myself. She looked so wasted, in fact, it occurred to me that she was dying before our eyes. The case was consuming her. She was never built for this sort of fight. She had never been hard. She had never had to be. Life never hardened her. It was not her fault, of course. But to me, who felt unbreakable even this late in the events, Laurie's fragility was impossibly poignant. I was prepared to be hard for both of us, for all three of us, but there was nothing I could do to protect Laurie from the stress. You see, I could not stop loving her, and I still cannot, because it is easy to be hard if you have a stony nature. But imagine what it cost Laurie that day as she sat bolt upright at the edge of her chair, gamely focused on the doctor, ready for yet another blow. She never stopped defending Jacob, never stopped analyzing the chessboard, calculating every move and countermove. She never stopped protecting him, even in the end. Dr. Vogel said, "Why don't I just explain my conclusions a little bit? Then afterward I'll answer your questions if you have any, okay? I know it's very, very hard to hear difficult news about Jacob, but brace yourselves for just a few minutes, okay? Just listen, then we can talk." We nodded. Jonathan said, "For the record, none of this is discoverable by the prosecution. You don't have to worry. Everything we discuss here and everything Dr. Vogel tells you now is privileged. This conversation is absolutely confidential. It never leaves this room. So you can speak frankly, as can the doctor, okay?" More nodding. "I don't understand why we have to do this," I said. "Jonathan, why do we even have to get into this if our defense is that Jacob didn't do it at all?" Jonathan made a V of his hand and stroked his short white beard. "I hope you're right. I hope the case goes well and we never have to raise this issue." "Then why do this?" Jonathan turned away slightly, dismissing me. "Why do this, Jonathan?" "Because Jacob looks guilty." Laurie gasped. "I don't mean that he is guilty, only that there is a lot of evidence against him. The Commonwealth has not put up their strongest witnesses yet. This is going to get harder for us, a lot harder. And when it does, I want to be prepared. And you, of all people, should understand that." "All right," the doctor said, wading in. "I've just given Jonathan my report. Really, it's an opinion letter, a summary of my conclusions, what I would say if I was ever called to testify, and what I think you could expect if this issue ever came up at trial. Now, I wanted to speak with you two alone first, without Jacob. I have not shared my conclusions with Jacob. When this case is over, depending on how it goes, we can have a more meaningful conversation about how to deal with some of these issues in a clinical setting. But for now, our concern is not therapy, it is the trial. I was engaged for a specific purpose, as an expert for the defense, so that's why Jacob is not in this room now. He will have a lot more work to do when the trial is over. But for now, we need to speak candidly about him, which may be easier if he's out of the room. There are two disorders that Jacob exhibits pretty clearly: narcissistic personality disorder and reactive attachment disorder. There is some suggestion of an antisocial personality disorder as well, which is a not uncommon comorbidity, but because I'm not as certain of the diagnosis, I haven't included it in my report. It is important to realize that not all the behaviors I'm going to describe are necessarily pathological, even in combination. To some extent, every teenager is a narcissist. Every adolescent is dealing with attachment issues. It is a matter of degree. We are not talking about a monster here. We're talking about an ordinary kid, only more so. So I don't want you to hear this as a condemnation. I want you to use the things I'm telling you, not be overwhelmed by them. I want to give you the tools, the vocabulary, to help your son. The point is to understand Jacob better, okay? Laurie? Andy? We agreed, obediently, dishonestly. Good. Okay. Narcissistic personality disorder. This is the one you probably know something about. Its primary characteristics are grandiosity and a lack of empathy. In Jacob's case, the grandiosity does not come across as dramatic or boastful, arrogant, haughty, which is what people commonly associate with it. Jacob's grandiosity is quieter. It shows up as an inflated sense of self-importance, a conviction he is special, exceptional. Rules that might apply to others do not apply to him. He feels he is not understood by his peers, especially the other kids at school, with a few select exceptions whom Jacob identifies as special like him, usually based on their intelligence. The other key aspect of NPD, especially in the context of a criminal case, is lack of empathy. Jacob exhibits an unusual coldness toward others, even, and this surprised me given the context, even for Ben Rifkin and his family. When I asked Jacob about it in one of our sessions, his response was that people die every day by the millions, that car crashes are statistically more significant than murder, that soldiers kill thousands more and get medals for it, so why should we worry about one murdered boy? Even when I tried to lead him back to the Rifkins and prodded him to express some sort of feeling for them or for Ben, he couldn't or wouldn't do it. All of which fits a pattern of incidents you have described throughout Jacob's childhood in which other children have been injured around him, children flying off jungle gyms and being knocked off bicycles and so forth. He seems to regard other people not just as less significant than himself, but as less human. He cannot see himself mirrored in others in any way. He cannot seem to imagine that others have the same universal human feelings that he does, pain, sadness, loneliness, which is a sensitivity that ordinary adolescents have no trouble understanding at this age. I won't belabor the point. The relevance of these feelings in a forensic context is obvious. Without empathy, anything is permitted. Morality becomes very subjective and flexible. The good news is that NPD is not a chemical imbalance, and it is not genetic. It is a complex of behaviors, a deeply ingrained habit, which means it can be unlearned over time. The doctor went on with barely a pause. The other disorder is actually the more disturbing one. Reactive attachment disorder is a relatively new diagnosis, and because it is new, we don't know much about it. There hasn't been much study done. It is uncommon, it is difficult to diagnose, and it is difficult to treat. The critical aspect of RAD is that it stems from a disruption of ordinary childhood emotional attachments in infancy. The theory is that ordinarily infants attach to a single reliable caregiver, and from that secure base they explore the world. They know that their basic emotional and physical needs will be met by that one person. Where that reliable caregiver is not present, or where the caregiver changes too often, children may relate to others in inappropriate ways, sometimes grossly inappropriate ways. Aggression, rage, lying, defiance, lack of remorse, cruelty, or overfamiliarity, hyperactivity, self-endangerment. The definition of this disorder requires some sort of disruption in early caregiving, pathogenic care, usually mistreatment or neglect by the parent or caregiver. But there is some controversy about exactly what that means. I am not suggesting either of you were deficient in any way. This is not about your parenting, but recent research suggests the disorder can arise even without deficient caregiving. Some children just seem temperamentally vulnerable to attachment disorders, so that even minor disruptions, daycare for example, or being passed from one caregiver to the next too often, can be enough to trigger an attachment disorder. Daycare? Lori said. Only in exceptional cases. Jacob was in daycare from the time he was 3 months old. We both worked. I stopped teaching when he was 4. Lori, we don't know enough to presume a cause and effect. You have to resist the urge to blame yourself. There is no reason to think neglect is the cause here. Jacob may just have been one of those vulnerable, hypersensitive children. This is all a very new area. We researchers are struggling to understand it ourselves. Dr. Vogel gave Lori a reassuring look, but there was a hint in her voice of protesting too much, and I could see Lori was not mollified. Unable to help, Dr. Vogel simply plowed on. She seemed to think that the best way to get across all this devastating information was to do it quickly and get it over with. In Jacob's case, whatever the trigger, there is evidence of atypical attachment as an infant. You've reported that as a child he seemed guarded and hypervigilant at times, or erratic and prone to excessive anger and lashing out at other times. Me. But all kids are erratic and prone to excessive anger. Lots of kids go to daycare and don't. It would be very unusual to see Rad, she pronounced it as a rhyme for bad, in the absence of some sort of neglect, but we simply don't know. Enough. Lori raised both hands in a stop sign. Just stop it. She stood and pushed her chair away, retreated to the far corner of the room. You think he did it?
I didn't say that, Dr. Vogel demurred.
You didn't have to say it. No, Lori, really, I don't have any way to know whether he did it. That's not my job. It's not what I set out to determine.
Me.
Lori, this is psychobabble. She said herself you could say these things about any kid. Narcissistic, self-centered. Find me a teenager who isn't like that. It's garbage. I don't believe a word of it.
Of course you don't. You never see these things. You're so determined to be normal and for us all to be normal that you just close your eyes and ignore anything that doesn't fit.
We are normal.
Oh, my God. Do you think this is normal, Andy?
This situation? No. But do I think Jacob is normal? Yes. Is that so crazy?
Andy, you're not seeing things right. I feel like I have to think for both of us because you just can't see.
I went over to her to comfort her, to lay my hand on her crossed arms.
Lori, this is our son.
She flailed her hands, batting mine away.
Andy, stop it. We are not normal.
Of course we are. What are you talking about?
You've been pretending for years. All this time you've been pretending.
No, not about the important things.
The important things? Andy, you didn't tell the truth. All this time you never told the truth.
I never lied.
Every day you didn't tell you were lying. Every day, every day.
She shoved past me to confront Dr. Vogel again.
You think Jacob did it.
Lori, please sit down. You're upset.
Just say it. Don't sit there and read me your report and recite the DSM to me. I can read the DSM too.
Just say what you mean. He did it.
I can't tell you he did or didn't do it. I just don't know.
So you're saying he might have done it. You think it's actually possible.
Lori, please sit down.
I don't want to sit down. Answer me.
I see certain traits and behaviors in Jacob that disturb me, yes, but that's a very different thing,
and it's our fault.
Excuse me, it could be our fault. It's possible that it might just be our fault, because we're such bad parents, because we had the nerve, the cruelty to put him in daycare like every other kid in this town, every other kid.
No, I would not say that, Lori. It is positively not your fault in any way. Put that thought right out of your head.
And the gene, this mutation you tested for, what do you call it? Knockout whatever.
MAOA knockout.
Does Jacob have it?
The gene is not what you're suggesting. I've explained at the most it creates a predisposition.
Doctor, does Jacob have it?
Yes.
And my husband?
Yes.
And my, I don't even know what to call him, my father-in-law?
Yes.
Well, there you go. Of course he does. And what you said earlier about Jacob's heart being two sizes too small, like the Grinch?
I should not have phrased it like that. That was a foolish thing to say. I'm sorry.
Never mind how you phrased it. Do you still believe it? Is my son's heart two sizes too small?
We need to work on building an emotional vocabulary for Jacob. It's not about the size of his heart. His emotional maturity is not at the same level as his peers.
What level is it at, his emotional maturity?
Deep breath. Jacob presents some of the characteristics of a boy half his age.
7. My son has the emotional maturity of a 7-year-old. That's what you're saying.
That's not the way I'd put it.
So what do I do?
What do I do?
No answer.
What am I supposed to do?
Shh, I said. He'll hear you.
Chapter 29. The Burning Monk. Day 3 of the trial. Beside me at the defense table, Jacob picked at a grisly nubbin of skin on his right thumb, near the nail. He had been scraping away at this area of his thumb for a while, nervously, absently, and had opened a little crack that extended from the cuticle down about a quarter inch toward the knuckle. He did not chew the cuticle, as kids often do. His method involved scratching the skin with a fingernail, lifting little peels and shavings until he succeeded in scooping up a substantial sliver, whereupon he would bear down and set about removing the rubbery protrusion by a battery of wiggles, tugs, and, when all else failed, slicing it with the dull edge of a fingernail. The area of these excavations never had a chance to heal. After a particularly aggressive excision, blood would seep from the wound, and he would have to squeeze his thumb with a Kleenex if he had one, or stick the whole thing in his mouth to slurp it clean. He seemed to believe, against all logic, that no one could be bothered by this nauseating little drama. I took the hand Jacob was punishing and moved it down into his lap, out of the juror's sight, then rested my arm protectively on the back of his chair. On the stand, a woman was testifying. Ruth Ann something or other. She was 50 years old or so. Likeable face, short plain haircut, more gray hair than dark, a fact she made no effort to conceal. No jewelry except a watch and wedding ring. She wore black clogs. She was one of the neighbors who walked their dogs along the trails in Cold Spring Park every morning. LeJudas had called her to testify that she passed a boy who roughly resembled Jacob near the murder scene that morning. It would have been a worthwhile bit of evidence if only this woman could deliver on it, but she was obviously suffering on the stand. She washed her hands over and over in her lap. She weighed every question before answering. Before long, her anxiety became more compelling than her actual testimony, which did not amount to much. LeJudas, could you describe this boy?
He was average, I guess. 5'9", 5'10", skinny. He was wearing jeans and sneakers, dark hair.
This was not a boy she was describing, it was a shadow. Half the kids in Newton fit the description, and she was not done yet. She hedged and hedged until LeJudas was reduced to prompting his own witness by sneaking into his questions little reminders, like cue cards, of what she had said in her initial answers to the police on the day of the murder. The prosecutor's constant prompting got Jonathan up on his feet to object over and over, and the whole thing became increasingly ridiculous, with the witness getting ready to recant the ID, and LeJudas too dense to get her off the stand before she made it official, and Jonathan jumping up and down to object to the leading. And somehow, it all faded into the background for me. I could not focus on it, let alone care about it. I had a sinking sense that this whole trial did not matter. It was already too late. Dr. Vogel's verdict mattered at least as much as this one would. Next to me was Jacob, this riddle Laurie and I had made. His size, his resemblance to me, the likelihood that he would fill out and come to resemble me even more, all this shattered me. Every father knows the disconcerting moment when you see your child as a weird, distorted double of yourself. It is as if for a moment your identities overlap. You see an idea, a conception of your boyish inner self, stand right up in front of you, made real and flesh. He is you and not you, familiar and strange. He is you restarted, rewound. At the same time, he is as foreign and unknowable as any other person. In the push-pull of this confusion, with my arm on the back of his chair, I touched his shoulder. Guiltily, he laid his hands flat on his lap, where he had gone back to picking the raw skin on his right thumb and had managed to pry up a new sliver. Directly behind me, Laurie sat alone on the front bench. She sat alone every day of the trial. We were friendless in Newton, of course. I wanted to enlist Laurie's parents to sit with her in the courtroom. I am sure they would have done it, but Laurie would not allow it. She was being a bit of a martyr here. She had brought down catastrophe on her own family by marrying into mine. Now she was determined to pay the price alone. In court, people tended to leave a foot or so on either side of her. Whenever I turned,
She was alone in that zone of isolation on the bench, distracted, her arms half-folded, her chin resting on one hand, listening, looking down at the floor rather than at the witness. The night before, Lori had been so shaken by Dr. Vogel's diagnosis that she begged one of my Ambiens and still could not sleep. Lying in bed in the dark, she said, "If he is guilty, Andy, what do we do?" I told her there was nothing to do at the moment but wait until the jury decided if he was guilty or not. I tried to snuggle with her to comfort her, which seemed like the husbandly thing to do, but my touch rattled her even more, and she wriggled away from me to the very edge of the bed, where she lay as still as she could but quite obviously awake, her sniffles and little movements betraying her. Back in her teaching days, Lori had been, to me, a miraculous sleeper. She turned off the light as early as 9 o'clock because she had to wake up so early, and she was asleep as soon as her head hit the pillow. But that was another Lori. Meanwhile, in the courtroom, LeJudas apparently had decided to ride it out to the end with this witness, even as she gave every sign of imploding. It is hard to justify LeJudas's decision in strategic terms, so I imagine he just wanted to prevent Jonathan from having the honor of eliciting her final recantation. Or maybe he still hoped, desperately, that she would come around in the end. But he would not give up, the stubborn bastard. It was actually sort of noble in a weird way, like a captain going down with his ship, or a monk dousing himself with gasoline and setting himself on fire. By the time LeJudas got to his last question, he had scripted the whole examination on his yellow legal pad and stuck to the script even as the witness improvised freely. Jonathan had put down his pen and was watching through his fingers. Question. Is the boy you saw in Cold Spring Park that morning sitting here in the courtroom today? Answer. I can't be sure. Well, do you see a boy matching the description you gave of the boy from the park? Answer. I'm really not sure anymore. It was a kid, that's all I know for sure. It was a long time ago. The more I think about it, I just don't want to say. I don't want to send some kid to prison for life if there's a chance I might be wrong. I couldn't live with myself if I did that. Judge French blew out a long, drawl sigh. He arched his eyebrows and removed his glasses. Mr. Klein, I take it you have no questions?
No, Your Honor.
I didn't think so. Things did not improve much for LeJudas the rest of that day. He had organized his witnesses into logical groups, and today was devoted to civilian witnesses. They were passers-by. None had seen anything especially damning from Jacob's point of view, but then it was a weak case, and LeJudas was right to throw everything he had into the pot. So we heard from two more people, a man and a woman, who each testified they saw Jacob in the park, albeit not near the murder scene. Another witness saw a figure running from the general area of the murder. She could not say anything about this person's age or identity, but the clothes roughly matched what Jacob was wearing that day, even if jeans and a light jacket were not exactly a distinctive uniform, especially in a park filled with kids walking to school. LeJudas did end on a harrowing note. His last witness was a man named Sam Studnitzer, who was walking his dog through the park that morning. Studnitzer had a very short haircut, narrow shoulders, a gentle manner. "Where were you going?" LeJudas asked.
"There is a field where dogs can run around off the leash. I take my dog most mornings."
"What kind of dog is he?"
"A black lab. His name is Bo."
"What time was that?"
"Around 8:20. I'm usually earlier."
"Where in the park were you and Bo?"
"We were on one of the paths through the woods. The dog had gone on ahead, sniffing around."
"And what happened?" Studnitzer hesitated. The Rifkins were in the courtroom, on the front bench, behind the prosecution table.
"I heard a little boy's voice."
"What did the little boy say?"
"He said, 'Stop, you're hurting me.'"
"Did he say anything else?" Studnitzer slumped, frowned, quietly.
"No. Just, 'Stop, you're hurting me.'"
Studnitzer did not answer, but clamped fingers over his temples, covering his eyes. LeJudas waited. The courtroom was so dead quiet, Studnitzer's sniffly breathing was clearly audible. He took his hand away from his face.
"No, that's all I heard."
"Did you see anyone else around you?"
"No, I couldn't see very far. The sight lines are limited. That part of the park is hilly. The trees grow thick. We were coming down a little slope. I couldn't see anyone.
Could you tell which direction the cry came from?
No.
Did you look around? Did you investigate? Did you try to help the little boy in any way?
No, I didn't know. I thought it was just kids. I didn't know. I didn't think anything of it. There are so many kids in that park every morning, laughing, fooling around. It sounded like just roughhousing.
His eyes fell.
What did the boy's voice sound like?
Like he was hurt. He was in pain.
Were there any other sounds after the cry? Pushing, sounds of a struggle, anything at all?
No, I didn't hear anything like that.
What happened next?
The dog was alert, hyper, strange. I didn't know what his problem was. I kind of pushed him along and we kept on walking through the park.
Did you see anyone as you were walking?
No.
Did you observe anything else unusual that morning?
No, not until after, when I heard the sirens and cops started screaming into the park. That's when I found out what happened.
Lejudas sat down.
Everyone in the courtroom was hearing those words in a loop in their heads. Stop, you're hurting me. Stop, you're hurting me. I have not gotten them out of my head yet. I doubt I ever will. But the truth is, even this detail did not point to Jacob.
To underscore this fact, Jonathan stood up on cross to ask a single perfunctory question.
Mr. Studnitzer, you never saw this boy, Jacob Barber, in the park that morning, did you?
No.
Jonathan took a moment to shake his head in front of the jury and say, terrible, terrible, to demonstrate that we too were on the side of the angels.
There it stood.
Despite everything, Dr. Vogel's awful diagnosis and Laurie's shell shock and the hauntingly ordinary words of the boy as he was stabbed, after 3 days we were still up, way up. If this were a Little League game, we might be talking about the mercy rule. As it turned out, it was our last good day.
Mr. Lejudas, let me stop you there for just a moment. I understand your wife was upset.
Witness, we were all upset.
Mr. Lejudas, but Laurie in particular was struggling.
Witness, yes, she was having a hard time handling the pressure.
Mr. Lejudas, more than that.
She was clearly having her doubts about Jacob's innocence, especially after you all spoke with Dr. Vogel and got the full diagnosis in some detail. She even asked you point blank what you two ought to do if he was guilty, didn't she?
Witness,
yes, a little later. But she was very upset at that moment. You have no idea what this sort of pressure is like.
Mr. Lejudas,
what about you? Weren't you upset too?
Witness, of course I was. I was terrified.
Mr. Lejudas, terrified because you were finally beginning to consider the possibility Jacob might be guilty?
Witness, no, terrified because the jury might convict him whether he was actually guilty or not.
Mr. Lejudas,
it still hadn't crossed your mind that Jacob might actually have done it?
Witness, no.
Mr. Lejudas, not once? Not for a single second?
Witness, not once.
Mr. Lejudas,
confirmation bias, is that it, Andy?
Witness, fuck you, Neil, heartless prick.
Mr. Lejudas, don't lose your temper.
Witness, you've never seen me lose my temper.
Mr. Lejudas,
no, I can just imagine.
The witness did not respond.
Mr. Lejudas,
all right, let's continue. Chapter 30, The Third Rail. Trial Day 4. Paul Duffy on the stand. He wore a blue blazer, rep tie, and gray flannel pants, which was about as formal as he ever managed to dress. Like Jonathan, he was one of those men it is easy to imagine as boys, men whose appearance almost forces you to see the boy inside. It was nothing particular about his physical features, but a boyish quality in his manner. Maybe it was just the effect of my long friendship with him. To me, Paul remained 27 years old forever, his age when I met him. For Lejudas, of course, that friendship made Duffy a slippery witness. At the start, Lejudas's manner was tentative, his questions overly cautious. If he had asked, I could have told him that Paul Duffy was not going to lie, even for me,
It wasn't in him. I would have told him also to put down his ridiculous yellow pad. He looked like a goddamn amateur.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Paul Michael Duffy.
What do you do for work?
I'm a lieutenant detective with the Massachusetts State Police.
How long have you been employed by the State Police?
26 years.
And what is your current assignment?
I am in a public relations unit.
Directing your attention to April 12, 2007, what was your assignment on that date?
I was in charge of a special unit of detectives assigned to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office. The unit is called CPAC for Crime Prevention and Control. It consists of 15 to 20 detectives at any given time, all with the special training and experience required to assist the ADAs and local departments in the investigation and prosecution of complex cases of various kinds, particularly homicides.
Duffy recited this little speech in a drone, from rote memory.
And had you participated in many homicide investigations prior to April 12, 2007?
Yes.
Approximately how many?
Over 100, though I was not in charge of them all.
Okay. On April 12, 2007, did you receive a phone call about a murder in Newton?
Yes, around 9:15 a.m. I got a call from a Lieutenant Foley in Newton informing me there had been a homicide involving a child in Cold Spring Park.
And what was the first thing you did?
I called the district attorney's office to inform them.
Is that standard procedure?
Yes.
The local department is required by law to inform the state police of all homicides or unnatural deaths. Then we inform the DA immediately.
Who specifically did you call?
Andy Barber.
Why Andy Barber?
He was the first assistant, which means he was the second in command to the district attorney herself.
What was your understanding about what Mr. Barber would do with that information?
He would assign an ADA to run the investigation for their office.
Might he keep the case for himself?
He might. He handled a lot of homicides himself.
Did you have any expectations that morning as to whether Mr. Barber would keep the case for himself?
Jonathan lifted his butt 6 inches from his chair.
Objection. Overruled.
Detective Duffy, what did you think Mr. Barber would do with the case at that point?
I did not know. I suppose I figured he might keep it. It looked like it might be a big case right from the get-go. He kept those sorts of cases a lot. But if he put someone else on it, that would not have surprised me either. There were other good people there besides Mr. Barber. To be honest, I did not really think much about it. I had my own job to do. I let him worry about the DA's office. My job was to run CPAC.
Do you know whether the district attorney, Lynn Canavan, was informed right away?
I don't know. I presume so. All right. After telephoning Mr. Barber, what did you do next?
I went to the location.
What time did you arrive there?
9:35 in the morning.
Describe the scene when you first arrived.
The entrance to Cold Spring Park is on Beacon Street. There is a parking lot at the front of the park. Behind that, there are tennis courts and playing fields. Then behind the fields, it is all woods, and there are trails leading off into the woods. There were a lot of police vehicles in the parking lot and on the street out front. Lots of cops around.
What did you do?
I parked on Beacon Street and approached the location on foot. I was met by Detective Peterson of the Newton Police and by Mr. Barber.
Again, was there anything unusual about Mr. Barber's presence at the homicide scene?
No. He lived pretty close to the location and he generally went to homicide scenes even if he didn't intend to keep the case.
How did you know Mr. Barber lived near Cold Spring Park?
Because I've known him for years.
In fact, you two are personal friends.
Yes.
Close friends?
Yes, we were.
And now?
There was a hitch before he answered.
I can't speak for him. I still consider him a friend.
Do you two still see each other socially?
No, not since Jacob was indicted.
When was the last time you and Mr. Barber spoke?
Before the indictment.
A lie, but a white lie. The truth would have been misleading to the jury. It would have suggested, wrongly, that Duffy could not be trusted.
Duffy was biased but honest about the big questions. He did not flinch as he delivered the statement. I did not flinch at it either.
The point of a trial is to reach the right result, which requires constant recalibration along the way, like a sailboat tacking up wind.
All right. You get to the park, you meet Detective Peterson and Mr. Barber.
What happens next?
They explained the basic situation to me, that the victim had already been identified as Benjamin Rifkin, and they walked me through the park to the actual scene of the homicide.
What did you see when you got there?
The perimeter of the area was already taped off. The ME and crime scene services technicians had not arrived at the location yet. There was a photographer from the local police there taking pictures. The victim was still lying on the ground, the body with nothing much around it. Basically, they froze the scene when they got there to preserve it.
Could you actually see the body?
Yes.
Could you describe the position of the body when you first saw it?
The victim was lying on a hill with the head at the lower end and the feet farther up the hill. It was twisted so the head was looking up toward the sky and the bottom half of the body and the legs were on its side.
What did you do next?
I approached the body with Detective Peterson and Mr. Barber. Detective Peterson was showing me details about the scene.
What was he showing you?
At the top of the hill, near the trail, there was a good deal of blood on the ground, cast-off blood. I saw a number of droplets that were quite small, less than an inch in diameter. There were also a few larger stains that appeared to be what is called contact smears. These were on the leaves.
What is a contact smear?
It's when a surface with wet blood contacts another surface and the blood transfers. It leaves a stain.
Describe the contact smears.
They were farther down the hill. There were several. They were several inches long at first, and as you went farther down the hill, they became thicker and longer, more blood.
Now, I understand that you are not a criminalist, but did you form any impressions at the time or theories about what this blood evidence suggested?
Yes, I did. It looked like the homicide had taken place near the trail, where there were blood drops that had fallen. Then the body fell or was pushed down the side of the hill, causing it to slide on its stomach, leaving the long contact smears of blood on the leaves.
All right, so having formed this theory, what did you do next?
I went down and inspected the body.
What did you see?
It had three wounds across the chest. It was a little difficult to see because the front of the body was soaked in blood, the victim's shirt. There was also quite a bit of blood around the body where it had apparently been draining out of these wounds.
Was there anything unusual about those blood stains, the pooled blood around the body?
Yes, there were some molded prints, shoe prints, and other impressions in the blood, meaning someone had stepped in the wet blood and left a print in it, like a mold.
What did you conclude from those molded shoe prints?
Obviously, someone had stood or knelt beside the body soon after the murder, while the blood was still wet enough to take the impression.
Were you aware of the jogger, Paula Gianetto, who discovered the body?
Yes, I was.
How did that figure in your thinking about the molded prints?
I thought she might have left them, but I could not be sure.
What else did you conclude?
Well, there was quite a bit of blood that had been cast off during the attack. It had sprayed and also been smeared. I did not know how the attacker might have been standing, but I figured from the position of the wounds on the victim's chest that he was probably standing right in front of him. So I figured the person we were looking for might have some blood on him. He might also have a weapon, although a knife is small and pretty easy to dispose of. But the blood was the big thing. It was a reasonably messy scene.
Did you make any other observations about the victim, particularly about his hands?
Yes, they were not cut or injured.
What did that suggest to you?
The absence of defensive wounds suggested he did not struggle or fight back against his assailant, which suggested he was either surprised or never saw the attack coming and did not have a chance to get his hands up to block the blows.
Suggesting he may have known his assailant?
Jonathan levitated his butt a few inches above his chair again.
Objection.
Speculation.
Sustained. All right, what did you do next?
Well, the murder was still relatively fresh. The park had been sealed, and we immediately searched it to ascertain if there were any individuals in it. That search had begun before I got there.
And did you find anyone?
We found a few people who were pretty far away from the scene. No one seemed particularly suspicious. There was no indication that any of them were connected with the homicide in any way.
No blood on them?
No.
No knives?
No.
So it's fair to say that in the early hours of the investigation, you had no obvious suspects?
We had no suspects at all.
And over the next few days, how many suspects were you able to identify and develop? None. What did you do next? How did you continue the investigation?
Well, we interviewed everyone who could have had any information. The victim's family and friends, anyone who might have seen anything the morning of the murder.
Did this include the victim's classmates?
No.
Why not?
There was some delay in getting into the school. The parents in the town were concerned about us interviewing the kids. There was some discussion about whether the kids needed to have a lawyer present at the interviews, and whether we could go into the school without a warrant, into the lockers and things. There was also some discussion about whether it was appropriate to use the school building for the interviews, and which students we would be allowed to interview.
What was your reaction to all this delay?
Objection. Overruled.
I was angry, to be honest. The colder a case gets, the harder it is to solve.
And who was running the case with you for the district attorney's office?
Mr. Barber.
Andrew Barber, the defendant's father?
Yes.
Did it strike you by this time that there was something inappropriate about Andy Barber working this case when his son's school was involved?
Not really. I mean, I was aware of it, but it wasn't like a Columbine thing. We didn't necessarily have a kid-on-kid murder. We did not have any real reason to believe any of the kids at the school were involved, let alone Jacob.
So you never questioned Mr. Barber's judgment in this regard, even in your own mind?
No, never.
Did you ever discuss it with him?
Once.
And would you describe that conversation?
I just said to Andy that, you know, just to cover your derriere, you might want to pass this one off.
Because you saw a conflict of interest?
I saw that his kid's school might be involved, and you never know. Why not just keep your distance?
And what did he say?
He said there was no conflict, because if his kid was ever in danger from a murderer, then that was all the more reason he would want to see the case solved. Plus, he said he felt some responsibility because he lived in the town and there weren't many homicides there, so he figured people would be especially upset. He wanted to do the right thing for them.
LeJudas paused at that last phrase and glared at Duffy for just an instant.
Did Mr. Barber, the defendant's father, ever suggest that you pursue a theory that one of Ben Rifkin's classmates might have murdered him?
No, he never suggested that or ruled it out.
But he did not actively pursue a theory that Ben was killed by a classmate.
No, but you don't actively pursue.
Did he try to steer the investigation in any other direction?
I don't understand. Steer it?
Did he have any other suspects in mind?
Yes. There was a man named Leonard Patz who lived near the park, and there was some circumstantial indication he might be involved. Andy wanted to pursue that suspect.
In fact, wasn't Andy Barber the only one pushing Patz as a suspect?
Objection. Leading.
Sustained.
This is your witness, Mr. LeJudas.
Withdraw the question.
You did ultimately interview the children, Ben's classmates at the McCormick School.
Yes.
And what did you learn?
Well, we learned at some length, because the kids were not very forthcoming, that there was an ongoing beef between Ben and the defendant, between Ben and Jacob. Ben had been bullying Jacob. That led us to begin considering Jacob as a suspect.
Even while his father ran the investigation?
Certain aspects of the investigation had to be carried out without Mr. Barber knowing.
This came as a hammer blow to me. I had not heard it before.
I had assumed something like it, but not that Duffy himself was involved.
He must have seen my face fall because a helpless look crossed his face.
And how did this come about? Was another assistant DA appointed to investigate the case without Mr. Barber's knowledge?
Yes, you.
And this was done on whose approval?
The district attorney, Lynn Canavan.
And what did this investigation reveal?
Evidence developed against the defendant to the effect that he had a knife consistent with the wounds, he had sufficient motive, and most important, he had stated his intention to defend himself with the knife if the victim continued to bully him. The defendant had also come to school with a small amount of blood on his right hand that morning, blood drops. We learned these things from the defendant's friend, Derek Yu.
The defendant had blood on his right hand?
According to his friend Derek Yu, yes.
And he had announced his intention to use the knife on Ben Rifkin?
That's what Derek Yu informed us.
At some point, did you become aware of a story on a website called The Cutting Room?
Yes, Derek Yu described that to us as well.
And did you investigate this website, the Cutting Room?
Yes, it is a site where people post fantasy stories that are mostly about sex and violence, including some very disturbing...
Objection!
Sustained.
Did you find a story on the Cutting Room website that related to this case?
Yes, we did. We found a story that described the murder essentially from the murderer's point of view. The names were changed and some of the details were a little off, but the situation was the same. It was obviously the same case.
Who wrote that story?
The defendant did.
How do you know that?
Derek, you informed us the defendant had told him.
Were you able to confirm that in any other way?
No. We were able to determine the ISP of the computer the story was originally uploaded from, which is like a fingerprint identifying where the computer is located. It came back to the Pete's Coffee Shop in Newton Center.
Were you able to identify the actual machine that was used to upload the story?
No, it was someone who linked to the coffee shop's wireless network. That was as far as we could trace it. Pete's does not keep records of which computers jump on and off that network, and it does not require users to sign on to the network with a name or a credit card or anything, so we could not trace it any further.
But you had Derek Yu's word that the defendant had admitted writing it.
Correct.
And what was it about the story that made it so compelling, that convinced you only the murderer could have written it?
Every detail was there. The clincher for me was that it described the angle of the knife wounds. The story said the stabs were planned to enter the chest at an angle that would allow the knife blade to penetrate between the ribs to maximize the damage to internal organs. I don't think anyone would know about the knife angle. It wasn't public information, and it would not be an easy detail to guess because it requires the attacker hold the knife at an unnatural angle, horizontally, so it slips between the ribs. Also, the level of detail, the planning, it was essentially a written confession. I knew we had probable cause to arrest at that point.
But you did not arrest the defendant immediately?
No. We still wanted to find the knife and any other evidence that the defendant might have hidden in the house.
So what did you do?
We got a warrant and hit the house.
And what did you find?
Nothing.
Did you take the defendant's computer?
Yes.
What sort of computer was it?
It was an Apple laptop, white in color.
And did you have the computer searched by specialists trained in uncovering material from hard drives of this kind?
Yes, they were not able to find anything directly incriminating.
Did they find anything at all that was relevant to the case?
They found a software program called Disk Scraper. The program erases from the hard drive traces of old or deleted documents or programs. Jacob is very good with computers, so it's still possible the story was deleted from the computer even though we couldn't find it.
Objection. Speculation.
Sustained. The jury is instructed to disregard the last sentence.
Lejudice.
Were they able to find pornography?
Objection.
Overruled.
Were they able to find pornography?
Yes.
Any other violent stories or anything connected to the murder?
No.
Were you able to corroborate Derek Yu's claim that Jacob had a knife in any way? Was there any paperwork from the purchase of the knife, for example?
No.
Was the actual murder weapon ever found?
No.
But a knife was found in Cold Spring Park at some point?
Yes. We continued to search the park for some time after the murder. We felt that the perpetrator must have ditched the knife somewhere in the park to avoid detection. We did finally find a knife in a shallow pond.
The knife was about the right size, but subsequent forensic analysis showed it was not the knife used in the murder.
How was that determined?
The blade of this knife was larger than the wounds would indicate, and it did not have a serrated blade consistent with the torn edges of the victim's wounds.
So what did you conclude from the fact that the knife had been thrown in the pond there?
I thought it was put there to throw us off, to send us down the wrong path, probably by someone who did not have access to the forensic reports describing the wounds and the likely characteristics of the weapon.
Any guesses about who might have planted that knife?
Objection. Calls for speculation.
Sustained.
Lejudice considered a moment. He took a deep, satisfied breath, relieved, finally, to have a professional witness to work with. That Duffy knew and liked me, that he was somewhat biased in Jacob's favor and visibly conflicted about being on the stand, only made his testimony the more damning.
Finally, Lejudice evidently felt.
Finally.
No further questions, he said. Jonathan bounced up and went to a spot at the far end of the jury box where he leaned against the rail. If he could have climbed into the jury box itself to ask his questions, he would have.
Or the knife might have just been dropped there for no reason at all, he said.
It's possible.
Because things are tossed away in parks all the time.
True.
So when you say that the knife may have been planted there to deceive you, that's a guess, isn't it?
An educated guess, yes.
A wild guess, I'd say.
Objection.
Sustained.
Let's go back a little, Lieutenant. You testified that there was a lot of blood found at the scene. Cast-off blood, spatters, contact smears, and of course the victim's shirt was soaked in blood.
Yes.
There was so much blood, in fact, you testified that when you went off to search the park for suspects, you were looking for someone with blood on him. Isn't that what you said?
Looking for someone who might have blood on him, yes.
A lot of blood on him?
I was not certain of that.
Oh, come on now. You testified that, based on the pattern of the wounds, Ben Rifkin's attacker was probably standing right in front of him, correct?
Yes.
And you testified there was cast-off blood?
Yes.
Cast-off meaning it was thrown, projected, shot out?
Yes, but in fact, in a case with so much blood, with wounds this grievous, you would have to think the attacker would have quite a bit of blood on him because the wounds would spurt.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, but very likely, isn't it, Detective?
It's likely.
And of course, in a stabbing, the attacker has to stand quite close to the victim, within arm's length, obviously.
Yes.
Where it would be impossible to avoid the spray.
I didn't use the word spray.
Where it would be impossible to avoid the cast-off blood.
I can't say that for sure.
And the description of Jacob with blood on him as he arrived at school that morning. You heard this from his friend Derek Yu, isn't that right?
Yes.
And what Derek Yu described was that Jacob had some small amounts of blood on his right hand, isn't that right?
Yes.
None on his clothes.
No.
None on his face or anywhere else on his body?
No.
On his shoes?
No.
All of which is perfectly consistent with the explanation Jacob gave his friend Derek Yu, isn't it? That he discovered the body after the attack and then he touched it with his right hand?
It is consistent, yes, but not the only possible explanation.
And of course Jacob did go to school that morning.
Yes.
He was in school just minutes after the murder, we know that, right?
Yes.
When does school start at the McCormick?
8:35.
And when was the time of the murder, according to the ME, if you know?
Sometime between 8 and 8:30.
But Jacob was in his seat in school at 8:35 with no blood on him at all.
Yes.
And if I were to suggest to you, hypothetically, that the story Jacob wrote that impressed you so much, that you described as virtually a written confession, if I were to show you evidence that Jacob did not make up the facts in that story, that all the details in the story were already well known among the students at the McCormick School, would that affect your thinking about how important it was as evidence?
Yes.
Yes, of course.
Duffy looked at him poker-faced.
His job here was to say as little as possible, to pare away every extra word. Volunteering details could only help the defense. Now, on this question of Andy Barber's role in the investigation, are you suggesting that your friend Andy did anything wrong or inappropriate here?
No.
Can you point to any errors or suspicious decisions he made?
No.
Anything you questioned then or now?
No.
There was some mention of this man Leonard Patz. Even knowing what we know now, does it seem inappropriate to you that Patz was once considered a legitimate suspect?
No.
No, because in the early stages of an investigation you pursue every reasonable lead. You cast your net as wide as possible, isn't that right?
Yes.
In fact, if I told you that Andy Barber still believes that Patz was the real killer in this case, would that surprise you, Lieutenant?
Duffy made a little frown.
No, that's what he always believed. Isn't it also true that you were the detective who brought Leonard Patz to Mr. Barber's attention in the first place?
Yes, but and was Andy Barber's judgment about homicide investigations generally reliable?
Yes.
Did it seem odd to you in any way that Andy Barber wanted to pursue an investigation of Leonard Patz for Ben Rifkin's murder?
Odd? No.
It made sense based on the limited information we had at that time.
And yet the investigation of Pat's was never seriously pursued, was it?
It was stopped once the decision was made to indict Jacob Barber, yes.
And who made that decision to stop focusing on Pat's?
The district attorney, Lynn Canavan.
Did she make that decision alone?
No, I believe she was advised by Mr. LeJudas.
Was there any evidence at the time that excluded Leonard Pat's as a suspect?
No.
Has any evidence ever come up that clears him directly?
No.
No, because that angle was simply dropped, wasn't it?
I suppose.
It was dropped because Mr. LeJudas wanted it dropped, no?
There was a discussion among all the investigators, including the district attorney and Mr. LeJudas. It was dropped because in that discussion Mr. LeJudas pushed to have it dropped, isn't that right?
Well, we're all here now, so obviously yes.
There was a trace of exasperation in Duffy's voice.
So even knowing what we know now, do you have any doubts about your friend Andrew Barber's integrity?
No. Duffy thought about it, or pretended to.
No, I don't think Andy ever had any suspicions about Jacob.
You don't think Andy suspected anything?
No.
The boy's own father, who lived with him his whole life, he did not know anything.
Duffy shrugged.
I can't say for sure, but I don't think so.
How is it possible to live with a child for 14 years and know so little about him?
I can't say for sure.
No, in fact, you've known Jacob all his life too, haven't you?
Yes.
And initially you had no suspicions about Jacob either, did you?
No.
In all those years, it never seemed to you there was anything dangerous about Jacob? You had no reason to suspect him, did you?
No.
No, of course not.
Objection. Request that Mr. Klein not add his own commentary to the witness's answers.
Sustained.
My apologies, Jonathan said with a great show of insincerity. Nothing further.
The judge.
Mr. LeJudas, redirect.
LeJudas considered. He might have left it there. Certainly he had enough to argue to the jury that I was crooked and had hijacked the investigation to cover for my crazy kid. Hell, he did not even have to argue it. The jury had heard it intimated several times in testimony. In any event, I was not the one on trial here. He could have just taken his winnings and moved on. But he was puffed up from his newfound momentum. You could see in his face that he felt himself in the grip of a grand inspiration. He seemed to believe the kill shot was right there within reach. Another little boy in a grown-up's body, unable to resist the cookie jar in front of him.
"Yes, Your Honor," he said, and went to a spot directly in front of the witness stand. A little rustle in the courtroom.